is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Whew. We got, the clown car is growing on the Republican side. Bobby Jindal yesterday. Today it was Ted Cruz. Rick Perry, Texas idiots all mixed up in my brain. What can I say? I want to talk a little bit about that as time goes on. But I think one of the really interesting things, George Will wrote a piece absolutely trashing Senator Sanders, trashing Bernie. And, you know, when Republicans start trashing Bernie, keep in mind, you know, people who read George Will are not Democrats. They're Republicans, by and large, and conservatives, and right-leaning independents, right-leaning in quotes. And so when people like George Will, who regularly lies about things like climate change, starts lying about Bernie, and his piece is filled with half-truths at the very least, or deceptions, you know that the Republican Party is starting to get worried, because they have been planning for years to run against Hillary Clinton. They've got roomfuls of stuff to throw at Hillary Clinton. They're so ready for Hillary Clinton. Doesn't mean they can beat her. And as I've said many times, I'm not going on this program. I am not going to go circular firing squad on Hillary Clinton, because she may well be our party's nominee, and I will enthusiastically support her and vote for her. She may not be right on every single one of my issues, and we still don't know where she's at on TPP. Probably not where I want her to be. But she's a Democrat. There's 4 Supreme Court seats coming up, and she is right on an awful lot of stuff. I mean, right now, for example, she's proposing that all across the nation we have, 20 days of early voting. Right? Let's get more people involved in voting. In fact, there's a great quote from Bernie. My pile has gotten so large, I'm losing things in it. So I'll just do it from memory. He was talking about how, you know, there was such a low voter turnout. And he said, you know, I think what happened is that people just got so cynical with politicians saying one thing and doing another, with, you know, government not working, that 64% of Americans said, I'm just not going to vote. I don't trust the system. I just got a note. This apparently came from FB.com/girldujour. Oh, this is from John Fugelsang. Oh, okay. This is a tweet from June 3rd. It is. John's at the very bottom. He's credited for it. He says, they tell me Bernie Sanders can't win because America won't vote for a socialist Jew. I tell them America celebrates a socialist Jew every December 25th. Yeah. Boom, boom. But what particularly makes me crazy, and I think should all of us, about the news coverage around the elections and the mythology that is being served to us aggressively by the Republicans, but mostly it's, you know, in this sneaky way. Remember Henry Wallace back in 1944? He said the real fascists, you know, they're not into violence; they're into poisoning the channels of public information. Is the idea that Bill Clinton won in 1992 by campaigning as a centrist Democrat. In other words, as a almost Republican Democrat. Now, you know, longtime listeners to this program have heard me read the 1956 presidential campaign platform of Dwight Eisenhower. We know that Dwight Eisenhower governed to the left of Bill Clinton. So, yeah, he governed as a centrist Democrat. But did he run as one? Was he elected as one? Did the American people choose him because they thought, oh, yeah, he's going to end welfare as we know it? There's this a piece in Salon by Connor Lynch titled The 1% Centrist Propaganda War, Why Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren Are So Threatening to the Establishment. And you know, he talks about this question floating around whether the Democratic Party should be embracing the liberal movement led by people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, or falling back to a more centrist plan that Bill Clinton embraced in the 90s. It is a question that's being posed by the right wing and Wall Street Democrats. Well, let me tell you, Bill Clinton did not campaign as a centrist Democrat. I wrote about this in my book, Threshold, The Crisis of Western Civilization, which is now out in paperback. Reading from page 37. This is the stump speech that Bill Clinton campaigned on. It was called his New Covenant speech. I'm going to also read from his nomination, his accepting the nomination of his party speech, which echoes these themes. But this was 1991 when he was running to be the Democratic candidate for president and then running to be the Democratic president in 92. Quote, I'm quoting Bill Clinton, running for office before he had been president. We've got to rebuild our political life before the demagogues and the racists and those who pander to the worst in us bring this country down. People once looked at the president and Congress to bring us together, to solve problems, to make progress. Now, in the face of massive challenges, our government stands discredited. Our people are disillusioned. There's a hole in our politics where our sense of common purpose used to be. He's talking about the Bush and Reagan administrations. He says, to turn America around, we've got to have a new approach founded on our most sacred principles as a nation with a vision for the future. We need a new covenant, a solemn agreement between the people and their government to provide opportunity for everybody, to inspire responsibility throughout our society and restore a sense of community to our great nation. A new covenant to take government back from the powerful interests in the bureaucracy and give it to the ordinary people of our country. More than 60 years ago, Franklin Roosevelt renewed that promise with a new deal that offered opportunity in return for hard work. Today, we need to forge a new covenant that will repair the damaged bond between the people and their government, restore our basic values, embed the idea that a country has the responsibility to help people get ahead. And most important of all, we are in this together. We have the good words of Thomas Jefferson, who once said, a debt of service is due from every man to his country, proportional to the bounties which nature and fortune have measured to him. In other words, let the rich pay their fair share. Bill Clinton campaigning for president. That was not campaigning as a Democrat light or as a centrist. He was, Bill Clinton campaigned in 1992. I remember. I'm an old fart. I remember. He campaigned in 1992 as a liberal, an aggressive progressive. As I noted in my book Threshold, a majority of voters in 92 were old enough to remember what America was like from 1940 to 1981, the New Deal era before Reagan, when a single worker with a good job had health care, a pension, and could raise a family and buy a home. When the GI Bill educated millions, when hospitals and health insurance companies in nearly every state were required by law to be not-for-profit corporations, and health care was inexpensive and widely available. And they had noticed that the 12 years of Reagan and Bush had begun the process of shattering that historic era, that the middle class was slipping away, that government had become remote and hostile rather than protecting the rights of workers and the middle class. Americans elected Clinton based on his FDR-style rhetoric. Here's his acceptance speech when the party nominated him. By the way, Peter Wenner, writing in the New York Times, he says, to see just how far the Democratic Party has moved to the left, compare Barack Obama with Bill Clinton. In 1992, Mr. Clinton ran as a centrist Democrat. This is the third paragraph of an opinion piece by Peter Wenner in the New York Times. It's a lie. He did not, or it's a misstatement, let's say, Peter. He did not run as a centrist. In his acceptance speech, he said, it is time to change America. I have news for the forces of greed and the defenders of the status quo. Your time has come and gone. It is time for a change in America. I'm telling you, Americans elect progressives when progressives, or at least they will elect someone based on progressive rhetoric. More right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I just want to put this whole myth to bed that Clinton campaigned as a centrist, because he didn't. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Susan, in Worcester, Ohio, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
I have a comment about those people who call Bernie a socialist.
Well, Bernie calls Bernie a democratic socialist.
That's right. Okay. Well, I mean, in a derogatory manner.
Right.
Okay. I'm not talking about the real thing. I'm talking about the way people perceive socialism.
Right.
And I think people don't understand that socialism is a form of economic system. It's not a form of government.
Well, it's actually a combination of it's a combination of the two. It's government regulating the economy, government regulating capitalism in a way that it works for everybody, not just the few. And it's government also redistributing income in ways that are, you know, that are meaningful so that, you know, people can live their lives. If your question is how do you discuss this with people who say, but Bernie's a socialist, is that the question behind your question?
Yes.
Okay, here's how I would answer it. I would say in the democratic socialist countries like Germany, college education is free because the government gets it that for every dollar they invest in college education for their people, for their young people, over the course of the lifespan of those people, they'll get $7 back in additional tax revenue. It's actually an investment. It's profitable for the country. It's a good thing. That's democratic socialism, free college. In democratic socialist countries like Germany, France, you know, all of Scandinavia, healthcare is considered a right and not a privilege. And now that is not, you know, you can call that socialism if you want, but Thomas Jefferson essentially wrote it into the Declaration of Independence. You know, nature's God decided that we should have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life if you discover that you have cancer or heart disease or diabetes and you can't afford to pay for the treatment?
Right.
So you know, if you want to call socialism, you know, free health care, free college education, better public transportation, so even, you know, even low-income people can get to work, you know, good subway systems, good roads. If you want to call that socialism, I would call it socialism, and that's fine, and that would make me a democratic socialist, too. And I'm proud of it.
Mm-hmm. That's what I am.
Yeah, I think that's what we all are. I mean, this is what's so incredible is back in the 30s, the big Republican hit on FDR was that he was a socialist. In the 60s, the big hit on Lyndon Johnson with the Great Society from the Republicans was that he was a socialist. Well, in this context, they both were. The Great Society was a democratic socialist program. The New Deal was a democratic socialist program. America loved them both. And it took election fraud and lies, largely lies and misrepresentation, and a massive propaganda machine of right-wing hate radio all across the country owned by, you know, giant right-wing corporations and Fox News run by a billionaire who was willing to lose $500 million to get it off the ground. It took that to push back against what the American people actually want. And you look at any poll, the American people, Medicare, Social Security. Do you like Medicare and Social Security? Those are democratic socialist programs. Do you think we should do away with them?
Exactly. Public schools, libraries.
Public schools, libraries, exactly. These are all public fire departments. You know, Chicago used to have private fire departments where you had to, you know, have the little medallion on your house. If you had the wrong fire department or if you didn't pay the fee, you didn't have the medallion, your house would burn down. That didn't work so well. When a couple of houses caught on fire, it spread through the whole city. Susan, thank you for your call. It's a great one. We'll be back. Okay, Bill Clinton, in his inaugural address, excuse me, in his acceptance speech, this is July 16th, 1992, New York City, the acceptance speech to the Democratic National Convention by Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas. Let's just set the record straight, okay? I've heard this, you know, at least 100 times coming out of the mouth of Joe Scarborough. He's even got Mika Brzezinski saying it, as I recall. You hear it constantly from, you know, conventional wisdom. People say, oh, well, Bill Clinton in 92 campaigned as a centrist Democrat, a third way Democrat, a middle of the road Democrat. I mean, that's what America wants, isn't it? And a Democrat, shouldn't our Democratic nominee be a middle of the road, you know, sort of a Republican light? Isn't that what America wants? No. Here are some excerpts from Bill Clinton's acceptance speech. Again, he didn't govern, and I'll explain why, didn't govern as a progressive, but he campaigned as one and he won the election campaigning as one. He said, just as we have won the Cold War abroad, we are losing the battles for economic opportunity and social justice here at home. It's time to change America. I have news for the forces of greed and the defenders of the status quo, your time has come and gone. It's time for a change in America. Of course, agreed in the status quo, of course, the Reagan-Bush administration. He said, that's why I'm so committed to make sure every American gets the health care that saved my mother's life and that women's health care gets the same attention as men's. For too long, those who play by the rules and keep the faith have gotten the shaft, and those who cut corners and cut deals have been rewarded. A president, Bill Clinton, I'm skipping through the speech, by the way, this isn't contiguous. A president ought to be a powerful force for progress. We've gone from being first in the world in wages since Ronald Reagan, we've gone from first to 13th in the world in wages since Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush have been in office. And what is George Bush doing about our economic problems? 4 years ago, he promised 15 million new jobs. By this time, he's over 14 million short. Al Gore and I can do better. He has raised taxes on the people driving pickup trucks and lowered taxes on the people riding in limousines. We can do better. He has doubled the national debt. This is Bill Clinton talking about George Herbert Walker Bush. He won't take on the big insurance companies and the bureaucracies that control health costs and give us affordable health care for all Americans, but I will, said Bill Clinton in his acceptance speech. He's speaking of George Bush the first. He won't break the stranglehold the special interests have on our elections and the lobbyists have on our government, but I will. He won't give mothers and fathers the simple chance to take some time off from work when a baby is born or a parent is sick, but I will. He won't take the lead in protecting the environment and creating new jobs and environmental technologies for the 21st century, but I will. Starting to sound like Bernie Sanders? This is how Bill Clinton won an election in 1992. Jobs, quoting again from Bill Clinton, jobs, education, health care, those are not just commitments from my lips. They are the work of my life. Our priorities must be clear. We must put our people first again. The Republicans have campaigned against government for a generation. But have you noticed? They've run the big government for a generation and they haven't changed a thing. They don't want to fix government. They just want to campaign against it and that's all. Trickle-down economics has sure failed, said Bill Clinton. You must do your part. You must be responsible. American companies must act like American companies again. Let me start at the very beginning of that paragraph, actually. He says, an America that says to entrepreneurs and business people, we will give you more incentives and more opportunity than ever before to develop the skills of your workers and to create American jobs and American wealth in the new global economy. But you must do your part. He's talking to business. You must be responsible. American companies must act like American companies again, exporting products, not jobs. This is the guy who, 5 years later signed NAFTA. But like I said, this is how he won the election. This is where the American people are at. This is not at all about Bill Clinton or where Bill Clinton was at. This is about where the American people are at. And the lies that are being told to us and have been told to us for 30 years aggressively, particularly in the mainstream and corporate media, that America is a center-right nation. It's a lie. America is a, by the standards of conventional wisdom, a left country. You could call it center-left if you want. He said, this is what the New Covenant is all about. An America in which the doors of colleges are thrown open once again to the sons and daughters of stenographers and steelworkers. We will say, everybody can borrow money to go to college, but you must do your part. You must pay it back from your paychecks or better yet by going back home and serving your communities. Right? He was proposing free college in exchange for community service. Just think of it. Millions of energetic young men and women serving their country by policing the streets or teaching the children or caring for the sick or working with the elderly and people with disabilities. He said, an America in which health care is a right, not a privilege. In which the wealthiest few are asked to pay their fair share. An America at the forefront of the global effort to preserve and protect our common environment. We must reduce defense spending. It's also about our common community. We can restore our sense of unity and community. This is what Bill Clinton ran and won on. Ignore George Will and the nannery nanobs of, to paraphrase Spiro Agnew, of the mainstream media. America has always been a progressive country, at least at the level of the people. Periodically, our government gets seized by right-wingers and corporate forces, as it is now. But we are a progressive
You're
country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
The American voters want progressive ideals. It's why Hillary Clinton is talking progressive stuff. It's why Bernie Sanders is so insanely popular. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very hebetically ugly. The good, Boyden Slat. The 20-year-old founder and CEO of the Ocean Cleanup announced that his Ocean Clean system is set to launch in 2016. He wrote in a blog post, quote, taking care of the world's ocean garbage problem is one of the largest environmental challenges mankind faces today. The pilot program will operate off the Japanese Tsushima Island and will collect floating plastic as the wind and ocean currents push plastic through 2,000-meter booms. The system will be the longest floating structure ever deployed in the ocean and marks a bold step in reversing the damages that humans have caused to our oceans. The bad. Geraldo Rivera. On Tuesday, Geraldo argued that racist stop and frisk policies are the only way to end urban gang violence. Seriously, check it out.
Moreover, there is a civil war in the ghetto, in the black ghettos of America, and we have to wake up to it. And the only way to disarm the Bloods and the Crips and all these gangs and crews is with stop, question, and frisk. It is constitutional if applied appropriately. And to take it away from the cops, take this vital tool away, is to hobble them along with, as Eric correctly points out, the absolute disrespect that has been generated toward the police because of the incidents, the highly publicized incidents in Ferguson and Charleston and so forth.
All right, the black ghettos. That's funny. Geraldo doesn't seem at all concerned about the white gangs in this country, despite the fact that hundreds of weapons were seized following last month's gang shootout in Waco, Texas. Beyond that, stop and frisk is not constitutional. It's not used properly. And between 2004 and 2012, police using it found guns in fewer than 0.1% of stop and frisk cases. And the very, very ugly Mike Huckabee. The Republican presidential hopeful and grifter stooped to a new low when he made fun of the transgender community while speaking to the National Religious Broadcasters Convention earlier this year. Jake, take a look.
We are now in city after city watching ordinances that say that your 7-year-old daughter, if she goes into the restroom, cannot be offended, and you can't be offended if she's greeted there by a 42-year-old man who feels more like a woman than he does a man. Now, I wish someone had told me when I was in high school that I could have felt like a woman when it came time to take showers in P.E. I'm pretty sure I would have found my feminine side and said, Coach, I think I'd rather shower with the girls today. You're laughing because it sounds so ridiculous, doesn't it?
It does sound ridiculous because it's unbelievable that a presidential candidate can be so oblivious to the reality of the transgender community. And the fact that he's mocking a community's struggles as a way to cater to his base, that's very, very ugly. I mean, that's insane. That's how do you say it beyond very, very ugly? So my rant about, you know, America is, this is, you know, if you look at, you know, this is Peter Wenner's piece. This was actually about a week and a half ago, May 27th in the New York Times. Have Democrats pulled too far to the left? And then, he talks about how Clinton governed, not how he campaigned. And yeah, Clinton governed as a moderate Republican. But he campaigned as an FDR Democrat. And he won the election as an FDR Democrat. And I think if his wife is the nominee, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee of the Democratic Party, she is going to campaign as an FDR Democrat. And I'm hoping that she would govern as one. And if Bernie Sanders wins the Democratic nomination, you already know exactly where Bernie stands because he's stood in the same place for 35 years, all the years he's been in politics. There has been no change. He's absolutely consistent. And as far as I know, on every single issue that Bernie stands for, the vast majority, more than 50% of Americans, stand with him. And I think it's starting to scare the Republicans. I really do. I'm guessing it's starting to scare the Democrats, too, or at least the Hillary Clinton campaign, and certainly the third way Democrats, you know, the corporatist Democrats, that we can be Democrats and, you know, have a love fest with Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon, those Democrats. Bernie's got to be scaring the hell out of them. And that's the sad thing, is that the few Democrats that you will find in network television are those kind of Democrats. Because, hey, that's the kind of Democrat you become when you make 5, 10, 15 million bucks a year, I guess. Not always, but more often than not. So, anyway, get your thoughts on this. Michael in Newton, New Jersey. Hey, Michael, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking this call. Just to let you know that I am a candidate for the Democratic Party for the Assembly in the 24th District, so you know that right off the back.
Cool.
One thing I'd like to bring up.
Michael, feel free, if you've got a website you'd like people to know about, feel free to plug it right now.
Yeah, it's graystaple15.org.
Say that again.
Staple as in S-T-A-P-E-L. That's my running mate, Jackie Staple.
Okay.
But in any event, and we're in the most Republican district in all of New Jersey by far. We're outnumbered 6-5, 6-1 easy. Mm-hmm. But we're the only ones actually bringing any ideas. The one thing that constantly keeps coming up, though, is including Democrats. They keep talking that government is something as other in right. the anthropological sense. Government is not other. Government is us. The institutions of government are what we put there, the president, the Congress, the judiciary, all the way from the state house. The governor is not the governor, it's not the government in New Jersey. He is our representative. He
Correct.
Is supposed to be representing the general will of the people.
Correct.
And if we keep the narrative going on that government is other, it's other, it's other, people become more disaffected and disassociated.
And that's.
We have to bring it back home to the fact that we are the government.
Right.
We are the sovereign. We are the general will.
Yeah, and this is what, ever since Reagan, I mean, Reagan really hit on this meme and it resonated, that government is somehow the other, and now you've got, you know, even the militia groups out there, you know, showing up to help out Clive and Bundy against the government, and, you know, with guns. No,
exactly, against what? No, they're representatives. Reagan was masterful at this, and
yes.
Kudos to him for being a phenomenally gifted speaker. He was a gifted speaker. His policies, as far as I'm concerned, wrecked this country,
yep.
But... You know, that's, you know, we can have that debate all day long on policy and Huberman argument over whether whatever man he was doesn't serve our own purpose. But you're right. He's the one that started the idea that he took the 60s modicum that if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. So
right.
he turned that around and said, the government is not the solution. It's the problem.
Right.
Brilliant yeah. crafting on his part.
No, you're his part or the part of his speechwriters, because I'm not sure Reagan was all there even when he got elected. Actually, well, yeah, it's hard to say. But in any case, yes, I absolutely agree. And he was a brilliant actor. He knew how to read his lines. He knew how to say. And frankly, I think he was a pretty decent politician back in the 40s when he was a Democrat. He did a very good job campaigning for Harry Truman and Hubert Humphrey, for example. Michael, thank you for the call and good luck with your campaign. I wish you the very best. Carol in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First, thank you so much for educating all of us. I appreciate your positive attitude, but with regard to Democrats running as liberals, and then when they get elected and they get into office, to me they seem to turn into moderate conservatives.
Yeah. Well, in fact, let me just share with you, if I may, very quickly, and then you can continue your rant. Is that all right, Carol?
Sure.
In my book, The Threshold, where I quote the Bill Clinton New Covenant speech, I follow that with a paragraph that says, as Adam Curtis brilliantly pointed out in a special documentary series he did for the BBC titled The Trap, a few weeks before Bill Clinton was to be sworn into office as President of the United States, he was visited by Goldman Sachs CEO Robert Rubin, who had just taken a $40 million paycheck for his last year with Goldman and would soon become the head of Clinton's economic team tasked with carrying out the New Covenant, and Alan Greenspan. Rubin and Greenspan sat the young president down and told him the facts of life. Clinton would not govern as an FDR liberal. Instead, he must cut government, free trade, and reduce regulation of business. Clinton complied and has been richly rewarded. In his second inaugural address, he declared the era of big government is over. Back to you.
Yes, and the same thing, I think, has happened with Obama.
I think so, too.
What it is, I think, is the people who paid for their campaigns are collecting, and especially now, that's what the TPP is all about.
I think you're right. I really do. I can come to no other conclusion with regard to the TPP than that before, even before 2008, I mean, before the election, that somebody sat down with Barack Obama and said, you know, we will make you president. Here's the price.
Yes.
It's the only thing I can think of.
So that's very discouraging, which is why I truly believe that Bernie is our answer.
Well, yes, and the other thing is people power. I mean, I refer you to my book, The Crash of 2016, and I wish it was free online like several of my books are, but it's not. But it is in libraries. You can read it in libraries, and you can read enough of it online on Amazon that you can probably read this chapter. That when FDR first came into office, he came into office planning to govern as a moderate, right? I mean, you know, he had campaigned on lowering tariffs and continuing the programs of Herbert Hoover. But when he came into office, every member of Congress, their desks were piled high with telegrams. He was overwhelmed. He had Frances Perkins as his Secretary of Labor. She was conspiring with his wife, Eleanor, to create the New Deal. And we and they pushed him. And I think that, you know, I don't want to blame Obama's failures on us, because I think it goes way beyond that. But Obama, I don't think, ever felt really seriously pushed by the American people to be a progressive. And whoever the next president is going to have to. Carol,
you're listening,
thank you,
to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We have, you know, what's the old phrase? Eternal vigilance is the cost of freedom, or liberty, you know, the price of liberty. We have to be the eternally vigilant ones. Welcome back. Don in Fort Pierce, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I enjoy your show immensely.
Thank you.
And appreciate that you and Bernie, Senator Sanders, are discussing real issues, you know, things that the mainstream media is befuddled to speak about.
Yeah,
I have a different slant on the TPP and why Obama is behind it.
Okay.
I truly believe that China is going to back its currency with gold by the end of the year. And this will destroy the value of a dollar, and the trade agreement is going to keep all money in circulation.
Yeah, it's not going to happen, Don.
No.
China, there's no way that China can back their currency by gold. A, they don't have enough gold. B, it's a bad idea anyway, because their economy is growing at 7% a year. That means that they would have to import 7% more gold every year just to keep their currency from you know, wildly value, you know, the value of their currency wildly fluctuating. The gold standard is something that arguably could work for a small number of small countries in a pre-industrial world, but the gold standard is no longer viable. It's not, you know, it's not something that works, and it's not something that we should be trying to go back to.
Okay, I was just wondering.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Don. Good to hear from you, Bruce in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Bruce. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Dr. Hartman, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
First and foremost, I was wondering how are we, as a country, will we be able to grab in all these other votes that would probably help the Democrats win this one, say the folks in the U.S. protectorates and territories like Fiji and why have I heard anything about trying to get those votes in as well? People who are, for all intents and purposes, considered U.S. citizens but can't vote.
Right. I think that the reason why is because their vote is so small, it's inconsequential.
I hear there's about 4 million people all totaled.
Who are potential eligible voters, but the actual number of voters is much, much smaller than that.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. I kind of heard different. I was watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and he was discussing that same issue, that there's this huge number of folks that are actually citizens, but they can't vote in specifically presidential elections.
Right, because their nations are not states of the United States; they're protectorates. So they're not really full citizens, Bruce. That's the thing. I thought you were talking about the Americans who were living in those places. The Puerto Ricans or the citizens of the Solomon Islands or you know, whatever the various islands. What's the one where Tom DeLay went to where, you know, sex tourism was big, and so he took a whole bunch of Republicans, and they are allowed to say made in the USA when they have their slave labor, the women who work in the factories where they're locked in, send stuff to the United States. I forget the name of the island. But they're not actually full citizens of the United States. They don't carry U.S. passports. They have a variation on that which does not give them citizenship, and that's why they can't vote. To the best of my knowledge, you know, I haven't seen John Oliver's piece, and maybe I'm missing something, but Bruce, thanks for raising it. I'll have to track down John Oliver's rant and see what he had to say. I appreciate the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Admiral Weinpresser posting over at Democratic Underground. Okay, Bernie, I give up. I've looked at the three presidential hopefuls for 2016, Warren, O'Malley, and Sanders. And he says Elizabeth Warren is not running. Martin O'Malley is running and has the potential to be a great president, but his decision to wait to declare to the end of May was a strategic blunder. Sanders has gained momentum since entering the race and starting to garner positive press. He says, initially I shied away from Bernie because I believed the political expert perspective. Sanders can't win the nomination, and even if he could, he can't win the general election. Because he's too old, he's funny-looking and has a funny accent, he's Jewish, he's not the right physical type for the TV age, and his socialist ideas are too radical. And then he says, Bernie is 73 years old, so he's no spring chicken. Reagan was 69 when he first ran, Bernie is more vigorous than Reagan. And then he goes through and he basically breaks all these things down. Bernie's more vigorous than Reagan, and in terms of gerontological progress, the age of 74 today is perhaps relatively younger than 69 in 1980 when Reagan was running. Bernie sounds and looks funny to many people, I suppose, but I don't think that's a showstopper. Ross Perot sounded and looked much funnier than Bernie, but until Perot started acting crazy in the 92 campaign, it looked like he could actually win the election. He was ahead in the polls until his meltdown, which is true. Remember the meltdown where he said that I think it was the Republican Party was trying to sabotage his daughter's wedding, and everybody going, oh, geez, the guy's a conspiracy nut. Yeah, Bernie's Jewish, but after a black president and viable women candidates, is this a big deal? I don't think so, writes the poster, the op over at the Democratic Underground. In anthropological terms, Bernie may be an endomorph. He doesn't look this is now starting to get very, very complicated. But Bernie's radical ideas that he believes in science, he's gaining momentum because he's telling the truth and people are listening to him. Another old-fashioned radical idea. They are not reacting to his image. He walks the talk. He has fought his whole life for the 99% because of Reagan and the morons who followed him. Wealth inequality is at the worst level in history, rivaled only by the Gilded Age. Americans have become radical because they've been laid off, pensions lost, homes foreclosed, and no way to send their kids to college. Meanwhile, banksters not only don't have to go to prison, their profits are bigger than ever. The American people have had enough, and so have I. Okay, that's it, Bernie. I'm in. Yeah. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles.
Hi, good afternoon, Tom.
What's up?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Well, just about your conversation right now, as far as Bernie.
Yeah,
I think Bernie does have a chance. He does. He is a viable candidate, and what he does, out of all the other candidates, is he's bringing a different perspective, which is hope.
Yeah.
Because if you go back though, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he did come out. He did try to propose a living wage. I'm sorry. No, what was it? It was a bill that he was introducing where you'd have a living wage. You can also
FDR introduced the minimum wage, if that's what you're talking about. That came with the New Deal.
But he also wanted to, be able to give people medical care, just like Obamacare.
Yeah, that was the year before he died. He proposed the second Bill of Rights, and in that he said that health care should be a right of all citizens. Yes, you're right.
Yes, he did. And the sad part is, we get frustrated with our Democratic representatives, and we need to remember, as long as there's financing the way they do right now, as far as millions of dollars into campaign funds, we have to look at Democrats realistically as, they're beholden to corporations as well.
Yeah.
And we're not going to get a fair shake because corporations, you know, they've studied, I mean, you know, they've done this for years and years where they own both sides of the aisle. So we as regular, you know, hardworking people, we don't have a fair shot. We don't have a say-so in our government.
Yeah.
And that's the problem today. And until that changes, there's not going to be the change that we want.
I agree, but we can't be cynical. I'm telling you, the Koch brothers are putting almost $1 billion into this election because they know that elections matter. That's why we have to participate and we have to vote.
Okay, just watching Rachel Maddow last night and seeing what Texas is doing to regular people that, you know, they, if you can't get the proper IDs that you can't vote.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to be cynical, but what I'm trying to say is until we put a stop to this money that goes into campaigning,
you're right.
The problem is it's not going to end.
We have serious, serious opponents who are absolutely committed to oligarchy and plutocracy, and we have to maintain our commitment to democracy in a democratic republic. And there's a variety of things that that means, including, you know, amending the Constitution to undo the damage the Supreme Court has done. I'm with you, Charles. Thank you. Glenn in Hawthorne, Nevada. Hey, Glenn, question?
Yeah, hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Thank you for calling me. One thing I want to tell you,
I think you called
us. I certainly agreed with a couple of first callers that you had. I think they're right on. And Bernie Sanders is my man, I'll tell you. And I think I'm about the only person that thinks that in Hawthorne, Nevada. But anyway, what I wanted to ask you was about these petitions that every day on my email I get petitions and about, and there's things I fully agree with,
right.
You know, doing, trying to overturn.
Right. And so your question is, do they actually make it to the Capitol? Do they do any good? Is that the question?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. The reason that groups run petition drives is twofold. One, so like yesterday, there was 2 million petitions that were delivered at the Capitol around, what was the issue? Oh, yeah, it was the TPP. It was around the TPA. Actually, it was the TPA, Stop Fast Track. And so, yeah, if you had clicked on one of those petitions from Credo, you know, or Public Citizen or whatever, and you'd filled it in, your name, your petition would have been delivered to the Capitol. But the other reason that they do it is they want your email address so that they can keep in touch with you. And then they will start asking you for money. And if it's a group with which you agree and you don't mind that, then go for it. In fact, typically, you know, if they start sending you, I do it all the time. I'll click on a petition or sign it or whatever. And if that group starts sending me 5 emails a week, I unsubscribe or put them in my spam list. On the other hand, there are groups that I routinely sign their petitions and they only send me, you know, 1 or 2 emails a month. And I don't have a problem with that. I can handle it. So, you know, Glenn, you have to just do what you think is best. On the right wing, it's a whole different thing because there's a bunch of scams going on the right where they're mostly collecting money, and most of that money is going to the guys running the websites. And there have been some really good articles written about this, you know. But on the left, no, they're generally legitimate.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I don't know who Skinner and his buddy, I'm missing his name right at the moment, the guys who run Democratic Underground, get to do these little graphics that they put up at the top every day, the pick of the moment, the picture of the moment. But today's is hysterical. As we speak, Rick Santorum is the next joke I'm going to tell you. As I speak, Rick Perry is announcing that he's going to run for president of the United States. As far as I can tell, this is the first time in the history of the United States that an indicted, you know, somebody indicted for a felony, somebody facing an actual felony indictment, which has already come down. It's not anticipated. I mean, you know, it's Scott Walker may be facing a felony indictment, although he and the Koch brothers managed to pack the Supreme Court of Wisconsin with 4 hardcore right-wing Koch brother, you know, Kochhead conservatives. So probably they will not rule against him. But Scott Walker could be an indicted felon. But Rick Perry actually is indicted for a felony, and he's going to run for president. But, hey, it's the Republican Party. This is the party. You know, if it's really remarkable to me how the Republicans have one set of rules for themselves and another set of rules for everybody else. Like with sexual misconduct, you know, David Vitter was getting it on with hookers. And so what does he do? He, you know, it's the Republican thing. He goes and he says, oh, you know, I prayed to Jesus and I'm forgiven and all is well. And when he came back into Congress after doing that, his first day back into the Senate, the Republicans stood up and gave him a standing ovation for sleeping with hookers. And then he got reelected, David Vitter. Go figure, right? And he's not the only one. I mean, there's a long list, right? Newt Gingrich was boinking his mistress while he was, I mean, literally, he'd go out, he'd try to impeach Clinton, and then go back to his office and get it on with what's-her-name, Callista, his current wife, when she was his aide or whatever she was. And he was married to somebody else. And, you know, but Republicans, yeah, we'll forgive that for Republicans. But Elliot Spitzer, the guy that I think would have been FDR had he been elected in 2008. If you haven't seen the movie Client Number 9, you gotta watch it. It's the rise and fall of Elliot Spitzer, and it's an amazing documentary. Client Number 9. It's Netflix has it available right now. It's incredible. But the net is Elliot Spitzer was a Democrat and a Jew, and oh no, sorry, they don't get forgiveness. And he resigned. But anyhow, Rick Perry, indicted for a felony, has announced that he's going to run for president of the United States. Meanwhile, Rick Santorum, my source for this is the graphic at the top of democraticunderground.com. Rick Santorum lectured Pope Francis about climate change, saying the church would be better off leaving science to the scientists. Quick. Somebody call Rick Santorum and let him know that Pope Francis has a master's degree in chemistry. He really does. He is a scientist. Ricky, you're no scientist. The Pope is. See, the Pope is about to come to the United States and speak on climate change. And John Boehner is ruining the day that he invited him. And then Ted Cruz made a bunch of off-color remarks about Joe Biden. In fact, he said, Joe Biden, he's a joke, right? Joe Biden's son is being buried today, or this weekend. He's lying in state today. This is one of the things that leads me to think that Ted Cruz is actually a sociopath, somebody who's incapable of experiencing emotion. Because I've met Joe Biden. Joe Biden is one of the most genuine people. It's shocking how genuine Joe Biden is, person to person. I've seen him work a room with 300 people, and I've talked to him private. Well, not super privately, but I've talked to him alone, you know, in the presence of other people. And he is just astonishingly genuine. And he's had so much tragedy in his life. I mean, in a car accident, his wife and his son died. Son or daughter. I don't remember which. It might have been daughter. But one of his children and his wife both died in this car accident, and he was left with these two young sons that were like, you know, 4 and 7 years old or something like that. Bo, the one who just died of brain cancer, was one of those two. And, you know, a decade later or thereabouts, when they were teenagers, they came to him and they said, you know, he had been dating Jill, this physician that is now his wife. And they came to him and they said, we think, Dad, you ought to ask Jill to marry you. And he did. And, you know, I mean, this is a guy who's had more tragedy in his life than anybody deserves. And he's still an optimist, and he's still a positive guy and a good guy. If Joe Biden was running for president, I would support him. I would support him in a heartbeat. And he may end up running for president. Who knows? I kind of doubt it, frankly. But he's a decent man. Ted Cruz is not a decent man, in my opinion. Ted Cruz believes that he's been anointed by God to lead the United States as we go into the apocalypse. That's not decency. That's fanaticism. It's a form of insanity. And he wants to impose his religion on the rest of us the same way that the Taliban wanted to impose their religion on everybody in Afghanistan, and that, you know, and that ISIL wants to impose their bizarre brand of what they call Islam. It's not. On the lands that they're conquering. It's really pretty astonishing. There's a bunch of other stuff I want to get to. Let me get through this stuff here. Did you know that Germany last year, or maybe it was earlier this year, we talked about it on this program when it happened, banned tuition at colleges. They just said it is now against the law for colleges to charge tuition. You want to be a college, you got to figure out how to deliver college for free. And by the way, if you're an American and you want to go to a German college, it's free. You just have to get in. More than 4,600 U.S. students are fully enrolled in German universities. This is a 20% increase over the last 3 years. Meanwhile, here in the United States, student debt is at $1.3 trillion, but 4,600 Americans are going to college for free in Germany. It's amazing. Oh, by the way, when you're there, because you're not a German, you have to pay for health insurance. Health insurance for students in Germany is $87 a month. It's incredible. I mean, it's incredible beyond incredible. I mentioned Scott Walker and how he's rigging the courts for, you know, in anticipation of his own, or actually how his financial donors, presumably the Coctopus, are rigging the Supreme Court of Wisconsin in the possible anticipation of Scott Walker being indicted. Several of his top aides have been indicted. A couple of them have been criminally convicted for campaign shenanigans, illegally using money in ways that, you know, try to hide it. And he's facing this investigation into violating the campaign laws. And this is a great piece. It was published on June 2nd by Billy Koraher over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. And the headline basically says this, the whole thing, judges considering criminal probe into Scott Walker may be implicated in the same offense. The crime that Scott Walker and his buddies have already been busted for, are implicated in, is basically money laundering. You know, it's illegally laundering billionaire money for political purposes. And it looks like that same process might have been used, or something very close to that process might have been used, to get four hardcore right-wingers elected to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. And why was that so important? Because if Scott Walker is prosecuted, it's going to end up before them. And they owe their election now to the Coctopus, or whoever it was. I mean, these outside groups spent $2.5 million just to elect one guy, Justice Prosser. That's more than the judge's own campaign spent.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is what politics has devolved to in the United States, and it's why it's so important that people who actually believe in America get involved. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Brandy watching Free Speech TV in Lansing, Michigan, my hometown. Hey, Brandy, what's up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Hartman. How are you, sir?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm muddling admirably. Okay.
Hey. All right.
I had to write down just a couple of quick thoughts on how I feel true change is going to come, sir.
Okay.
And it is economic disparity is much like Pac-Man.
It's much like what? I'm sorry, your phone is a little muffled, and it's hard for me to understand what you're saying.
I'm sorry. I'll try again.
Sure.
Economic disparity is like Pac-Man.
Pac-Man.
It's moving. Pac-Man, okay. The game.
Yep.
It's moving up the income chain, and until enough white people become disposable, nothing will change.
Yeah.
My final thought, sir, until anger outweighs the fear, only true change will happen in our country that I love.
I think you're right. I think you're right on both counts. And this is what's happening. African Americans have known forever, you know, the difficulties of rising into the middle class in the United States, and now the white middle class, which, you know, through the era of my father, you know, through the era, the New Deal era from the 1940s to the 1980s, pretty much thought, hey, you know, this country is our country and everything is cool and like that. The white middle class is now getting screwed. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why you're seeing white middle class Americans jumping in on things like the Black Lives Matter movement, because they're realizing, you know, we're all in this together. And the efforts, the traditional Republican Party efforts of splitting white voters from black voters by saying, oh, you know, to the white voters, they're trying to get your jobs, just doesn't work anymore. Because every, you know, the white voters are getting it, that they're being, you know, not as badly screwed as black voters, but they're losing out too. And I think you're absolutely right. Brandy, thank you for the call. Joe in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Yes, I just want to, it would be wise if other Democrats like Biden, especially Elizabeth, I mean, Hillary Clinton and Sanders, then they need to join force, Webb, O'Malley, Kenny Chaffee, like, what, right now the numbers on Clinton are higher than whoever wins, and then and promise these Democrats, like, put him in, like, if Hillary Clinton wins, they can put like Kennedy, Chaffee, Foreign Affairs, like O'Malley in Wall Street, like Stasar on Wall Street, Biden on health. And stuff like that. I mean, we need to join force. That's the only way we're going to beat the evil Republicans, because they're destroying this country.
Yeah.
Like Hitler destroyed Germany.
Well, no, the Republicans aren't destroying America the way Hitler destroyed Germany. The Republicans are destroying America the way that they destroyed America in the 1920s, the way that they destroyed America in the 1870s. They're doing it by economic domination. They're doing it by plutocracy and oligarchy. It's quite different from what Hitler did with the Nazis. And I think that when we invoke Hitler and we invoke the Nazis, by engaging in that kind of hyperbole, we run some risks. But, you know, Joe, the thing to say, I would say, is that what the Republicans have been doing for the last 30 years is exactly what the Republicans did from 1920 to 1929. And it's going to produce the exact same result, which is an economic crash. A bunch of rich people are going to get richer, and everybody else is going to get a lot poorer. Thanks a lot for the call, Joe. We'll be back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. And Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, you are, go ahead. Say what you're going to say. Go for it.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay, how crazy is this? If anybody actually uses the Ben and Jerry stamp that's being offered on the free speech drive, which is intended to stamp money, does that actually mean that under federal statute that a person could be fined or jailed for defacing currency?
No, it does not. Shane and I had this conversation on the air back, what, months ago, you know, when maybe even a couple of years ago when Ben Cohen was in the studio and we were stamping all of our money. And I said, hey, wait a minute, Ben, am I creating a federal crime here? Am I doing a federal crime? It is only illegal to deface federal currency in ways that that changes its value, that, you know, where you take $5 bills and bleach them and turn them into $20 bills. That's counterfeiting, essentially, or in ways that render it, what, unusable? Yeah, valueless. If it renders the bill valueless, that's what under the law, then that's defacement. And there's even exceptions for that. You've probably seen these machines in tourist places where you put a penny in and then you put a quarter in. The quarter pays for it. The penny gets squished into a little round copper slug that's got the imprint of, you know, a train or Union Station or whatever it may be. You know, the law even provides an exception for that. So, no, if you stamp your money with the rubber stamps that Free Speech TV is giving away and that Ben Cohen gives away through his group, and Ben's got enough money to have, you know, thoroughly lawyered this, there is no chance that anything will happen to you. It's just a fine thing to do. Michael, thank you for the call. Stephen in Fowler, Indiana. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to make a comparison between Bernie Sanders and Jesse Ventura. Not so much in their political beliefs, but because I'm pretty certain that few people have the same political beliefs as Jesse Ventura.
Yeah, and Jesse's changed a lot since he was governor of Minnesota. He's gotten far more conspiracy-minded and what that's, many people would call kind of fringe.
I like Jesse, but go ahead. I'd be the first one to admit that some of Jesse's ideas are a little bit wacko. In fact, a lot of them are. But the one thing I keep hearing concerning the Bernie Sanders campaign is that if you vote for Bernie, you are in effect throwing away your vote because there's just no chance he can win.
No, wait a second. If Bernie was running in a general election as a third-party candidate, the way that Ralph Nader did in 2000, then yes, you would, you know, a vote for Ralph Nader in 2000 in a swing state was effectively a vote for George Bush, because it took away a vote from Al Gore. On the other hand, though, we're talking about a primary here. So if you vote for Bernie in the primary, you're taking away a vote from Hillary or from Martin O'Malley or from Lincoln Chafee. He just announced that he's going to announce. And so, no, you're not. It's not the case at all, Stephen.
Well, it may not be, but I keep hearing this,
keep pushing back on it because that's on several
news channels.
Yeah.
And the point I wanted to make is that I lived in Minnesota at the time of the election,
right.
And I went into that election booth really depressed. I didn't like either party's candidate, and I'd been hearing this about Jesse. I was throwing away my vote, and I said, to heck with it, and I voted for him anyway.
And he won.
And I remember very clearly waking up that next morning, and it splattered all over the news. That Jesse had this incredible upset in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And I just can't tell you how great it made me feel.
Yeah.
It was just a wonderful feeling knowing that even though that I went against what everybody was saying and went ahead and voted my conscience and in the first place got up to vote, period. Because that's always the first step.
Yeah.
But once I got there, I voted my conscience and I said, to heck with what everybody is telling me. I'm going to do what I believe is best.
Yeah. Well, good on you, Stephen. But anytime anybody tells you that a vote for Bernie is a thrown away vote, just tell them they're wrong. That they're within the Democratic primary, it's only one party. It's the Democratic Party, and it's the Democratic Party trying to figure out who its nominee is going to be in the general election. So you're simply voting for who's going to be the Democratic candidate for President of the United States. You're not voting for President of the United States. You're voting for who's going to be the candidate. There's a big difference between a primary, which is what we're talking about right now, and the primaries are going to be held basically from January through June of next year. There's a big difference between a primary and a general election. In the general election, the Democrats, it's going to be basically either a Democrat or a Republican who wins the White House and most Senate seats and most House seats. There's a couple of independents out there, Lisa Murkowski, Angus King, and Bernie Sanders, but they're the exception rather than the rule. And Lisa, she had a fight within her own Republican Party, and King, they all have their interesting stories. But I think that the comparison to Jesse Ventura is a good one in as much as it shows how a candidate who speaks populist language, which is what Jesse Ventura did in that campaign. He talked about the issues that people cared about. Jesse Ventura was a radical truth teller. And what year was that? That was in the 90s, wasn't it?
There was no doubt about what you were going to get with Jesse. I mean,
yeah.
You knew up in front that this guy had some wacko ideas, but at the same time, you know, he was at least honest about what he was saying.
Yes.
You knew it was coming from the heart.
And this is what I'm hearing from independents and from Republicans who call into this program, is that they would regardless of who the Republican nominee is, there's nobody in that clown car that you can really trust. And they're all changing their positions, or their positions are so outside the mainstream of America. You know, destroy Social Security, Medicaid, public schools. Really? You want to privatize our fire departments? I mean, really? This is the Republic. Republicans are saying, you know, Bernie might be the guy that I would vote for. I mean, you know, they can't vote for him in the Democratic primary, but if he was the nominee of the party. So we'll see. I mean, Hillary's got a lot of hoops to jump through between now and the primary, and a bunch of debates to go through, and it's going to be fascinating to watch. That said, you know, I'm seeing Hillary be taking more and more progressive positions, which is more and more encouraging to me. I'm very happy to be a Democrat right now. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with the news of the day, my thoughts on it, your thoughts on my thoughts on it, your calls after this. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of things I wanted to just riff on here and then, you know, pick up your phone calls. Rick Perry just announced that he's running for president. The former governor of Texas, longest-serving governor of Texas, apparently, in the history of the state. Here are some of the things that he believes, according to Ian Millhiser over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. Number one, Rick Perry believes that Social Security and Medicare are unconstitutional. Now, I don't recall a presidential candidate running explicitly on the platform of let's end Social Security and Medicare because they're unconstitutional happening before. Do you? I mean, maybe it has, but I mean, I realize they talk about this and they've been trying to destroy Social Security and Medicare ever since 1935 when they were put into place. But Rick Perry's actually running on this? End Social Security and Medicare because they're unconstitutional? He says all other federal health programs are also unconstitutional. So Obamacare is unconstitutional. Medicaid is unconstitutional. Aid to the WIC program? There's a program for single mothers who are living in poverty so that they and the children can have health. Well, and part of that is Medicaid, I guess. He says federal clean air laws are unconstitutional nonsense. And that might just reflect, you know, the fossil fuel billionaires helping fund his political career. He thinks federal education programs are unconstitutional. Yep, shut our schools. He thinks nearly all federal laws protecting workers are unconstitutional. He thinks that federal financial reform is unconstitutional. We can't write the rules for the banks. They have to write the rules for us. He thinks that voters should not be able to choose their own senators. The senators in the U.S. Senate should be, as was originally envisioned in the Constitution, amended in 1919, but he thinks that they should be appointed by whoever pays them the most money. It's the 17th Amendment. Maybe it wasn't 1919, but it was around that time. He thinks that investment income, you know, the capital gains tax, we have two kinds of taxes right now, two kinds of basically income taxes in the United States. If you work and you get a paycheck, you pay up to 39% income tax and, you know, you pay regular income taxes. If, however, the work that you do is moving money around, if you're a bankster like Mitt Romney or Jamie Dimon or one of those guys, and you pay yourself with stock options or with what's called carried interest or what's called pass-throughs, you pay what's called a capitalist gains or a capital gains rate. It's the capitalist gains rate. It's the special tax rate for capitalists. And he thinks that that tax is unconstitutional. In other words, Jamie Dimon and Lloyd Blankfein and Mitt Romney should pay nothing in federal income taxes. Why? Well, I don't know, because he's Rick Perry, I guess. Andy thinks that the activist judges are a serious problem. Actually, that's the one area where I may agree with Rick Perry.
Did I just say that?
Yeah, I did. Okay. Yeah, in that, I agree with Rick Perry, Phyllis Schlafly, and, a bunch of them. Newt Gingrich has been on this program. We've talked about it. Meanwhile, the San Carlos Apache tribe, I believe that they are still camped out at Oak Flat. This is a place where the Apaches have had coming-of-age ceremonies, especially for girls, for generations. I was at one. I wrote about it in my book, The Prophet's Way. There's a chapter in there, in that book, about my spending a couple of weeks with the San Carlos Apache on tribal land. They had invited us in, me and John Rady, who was with Harvard Medical School at the time. I think he still is, to talk about ADHD in their kids because so many of their kids were being put on Ritalin. I mean, like, you know, over 90%. I mean, it was shocking. And it was just over medication. So anyhow, what happened was the last year, December 2014, John McCain and Jeff Flake used to be a lobbyist for Rio Tinto. which is the mining company that owns Resolution Copper, which is the mining company that's going to get this land where the Apaches have these sacred ceremonies and have for 20,000 years. And John McCain, who's just basically a shill of anybody, they slipped this thing in just before it went. I mean, we didn't even know. Most senators didn't know that they were voting to give away federal land to a foreign mining company, federal land that had been protected by the Eisenhower administration because it was sacred to the Apaches. Now, can you imagine if an area, and I realize there aren't that many in the United States unless you're Mormon. But, well, let's take, you know, Mormons. The Mormons have got places that are sacred, you know, along the path that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young took and all that kind of stuff. Or if it was Mount Sinai, I mean, the Apaches are saying this is like our Mount Sinai. Would you privatize it? Would you start mining on Mount Sinai? Or, you know, where the Sermon on the Mount was held, or on Lake Galilee, you know, the Sea of Galilee. I mean, would you really start mining sacred areas if they were Christian or Jewish or Muslim? No. But Native Americans, hey, we don't even acknowledge the genocide of Native Americans in this country anymore. We don't talk about it. It's a footnote in our textbooks. And yet there's not a square inch of land that any of us can walk on in this the United States of America that wasn't once Indian land. And what small amount is left, John McCain and Jeff Flake, the two Republican senators from Arizona, slipped into this bill. It's too late, you know, it's not too late to do anything about it. There is an effort to undo this. And if you call your elected representatives at 202-225-3121 and say, you know, stop the giveaway of the sacred Apache lands. I knew these people. I mean, it's been 15, 20 years since I was out there, but they're good and decent people and struggling to get by. Horrible poverty. But they're holding their traditional values and traditions. I attended a coming-of-age ceremony for the daughter of the best friend of the fellow who invited me to the tribe. It was an all-day ceremony where we danced and prayed out in the sun from sunrise to sunset, and then we did sweats that night. It lasted several days, as I recall. And I wrote about it in the book with their permission. You can read about it. It's in my book, The Prophet's Way. In fact, the chapter title is A Visit to the Apache Nation. And now these people are being robbed by John McCain and Jeff Flake. I mean, this is just wrong. We should be ashamed as a nation. And then finally, you know, how am I, I'll get to this in a little bit. Because I know a lot of people are on hold and they've been waiting to get in here to participate in our conversation. So Arden in Carmel, New York. Hey, Arden, you're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Arden.
I'm in such awe. I love you. And every day I talk to you in my car. I'm surprised you can't hear me. But
the reason
I'm calling is because I just have a question. It may be rhetorical, but I wonder why the Treasonous Act of 47 Republicans doesn't get any weight, but emails and Benghazi for the fourth or fifth time gets all the publicity.
Right.
Why can't we dangle a carrot about treason? Or
there's a really simple answer to your question, Arden, and that is that the right wing echo chamber in this country, the vast right wing conspiracy that Hillary Clinton referred to when her husband was president, is real. That the media machine in this country, it starts with the crazy blogs, you know, the WorldNet dailies and Prison Planets and whatnot. From there, it migrates to the Drudge Report. from the Drudge Report, it migrates to Fox News and right-wing hate radio. From right-wing hate radio and Fox News, it migrates into the mainstream press. And pretty soon, everybody thinks that the IRS is punishing Tea Partiers, which they're not, or that Hillary Clinton did something nefarious with Benghazi, which she didn't, and all this kind of stuff. So that machine is in place on the right. It is very powerful. It's very effective. It's very well-funded. Hundreds of millions, arguably billions of dollars a year, go into that machine. There is no comparable machine on the left. And that's why nobody is regularly trashing the 47 traitorous senators who sent the letter to the Ayatollahs or the president of Iran or whoever they sent it to, saying, don't make a deal with our first black president, with this Democratic president. Don't you dare make a deal with him because we will screw it up. They are traitors in my mind. And they deserve to be called out. But there is no media, outside of Free Speech TV and a few stations around the country, the Pacifica stations and a few good commercial stations that are, like the stations that are carrying this program and other good progressive programs. We're the remnant of the real media in the United States. Since, Reagan began the deregulation of media. I mean, and there used to be media ownership rules and things, and they've all been thrown out the window. So the right-wingers, it's the Powell memo on steroids. I write about this in my book, The Crash of 2016, if you really want to get all the details and be able to argue it. And it's free in any library in the country. Arden, thank you very much for the call. And thanks for listening to Sirius. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, Lindsey Graham, isn't that cute? He's running for president. Oh, my. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes before the hour. And Mac, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Cowdery, Colorado. Hey, Mac, what's up?
Good afternoon, Professor.
How are you?
I wanted to comment about the one thing that distinguishes Free Speech TV from the rest of the media. Every on-air host that I've listened to on this channel has excellent critical thinking skills. It seems to be absent on every other media outlet.
You care to expand a little bit on that for people who don't understand what critical thinking is or aren't real familiar with the phrase?
Well, it's basically the ability to actually accurately analyze situations without prejudice.
Right.
And one of the things, that's the thing I think that distinguishes Free Speech TV. Your rant on Rick Perry got me to thinking about my life as a prosecutor in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I always fought against what I call the three Bs. That's bigots, bullies, and bandits.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that an awful lot of the Republicans fit in one or, sadly, more than one of those categories.
Yeah, tragically. You were a prosecutor in Texas?
Yes, sir.
Boy, I'll bet you've got some amazing stories to tell.
Well, some. I started out life as a street cop and then ended my career as a career prosecutor.
What are your thoughts on the current state of policing and prosecution in the United States, the state of our criminal justice system? If you don't mind my asking.
No, I don't mind at all. It has really torqued my jaws to have to sit back and see cops act so irresponsibly.
Mm-hmm.
I used to teach in the police academies, and one of the subjects was always the use of force.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't understand this reaction of you resorting to lethal force as the first resort.
Do you think,
it
Mac,
makes no sense.
Do you think, that's pretty much the norm when you watch cop shows on TV, and they're hugely popular. And I'm sure a lot of police officers watch cop shows on TV. Do you think that our media is driving the behavior of our police, or do you think that it's reflecting cultural changes in policing, or both? Is there a dog chasing its tail effect here? Or am I completely off base?
No, that's kind of accurate. One of the things that most people don't realize is when cops go through the academy, they get taught about all of the constitutional protections and civil rights and how those things are important.
Right.
As soon as they get on the street, most veteran cops think of constitutional rights as mere technicalities.
Right.
There are things that slick defense lawyers use to get criminals off.
Right. And their first goal, of course, is to get home safe, which we can all understand. But thinking that shoot first, ask questions later is the way to do it, not a good idea. Mac, fascinating. Thank you for sharing your perspective with us, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Thank you. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service is, where are you, at the UN, Luke?
That's right, Tom.
So what's going on?
Well, the UN has been very concerned about developments in Iraq over the last 48 hours, namely moves by the Islamic State to seal the dam on the Euphrates River at Ramadi. You know, it's sort of that turn of phrase we all use in this campaign against the Islamic State, where we call this city or that crucial or a strategic hub. Well, we have seen just this week really how apt of a, a word that is when it concerns Ramadi.
So if they close the dam in Ramadi, does that mean that the downriver communities are losing their drinking water? Is that what it's all about?
That's exactly right. Not just drinking water, which is particularly important now because, you know, the displacement from Ramadi has been tremendous. There are more than 250,000 people on the move, most of them downstream, left this city. So they are being affected in cities like Fallujah, cities like Habaniya, which is just sort of in the shadow of Ramadi. The UN, some folks in Iraq who I spoke to today were saying thousands of people have taken refuge in the riverbeds because they can get water there. Well, that's not going to happen for very much longer. We have already seen reports of the river beginning to dry up in spots. And beyond just the humanitarian component here, there is a military advantage for the Islamic State in doing this, too. They've essentially turned an area where they were effectively sort of cordoned off from Iraqi troops. They're sort of on an island, if you will. They have drained the water, and now their vehicles, Islamic State fighters, can break out of Ramadi and attack other areas without geographical impediments.
So, in other words, they don't need a bridge to get across the river because the river is now a dry riverbed.
Exactly right. You know, we've yet to see if this sort of change, physical change in the battlefield, is going to accelerate the plans we know have been in the works by the Iraqi government to try and retake this city. We haven't seen that push initiated just yet. Likewise, we haven't seen the Islamic State start to break out of Ramadi and go on some sort of offensive. So again, for the moment, this is mostly a humanitarian story. But the real concern here is that, you know, by reshaping the battlefield, they have tipped the odds in their favor and are using water as what the UN called a tool of war, which I think is a very apt way to describe it.
Yeah. I've been seeing headlines that the Red Cross raised $500 million for Haiti and has built like 8 houses. Is there something to that?
It was 6 houses.
6 houses?
The Red Cross has claimed they built up to 100, they housed at least 130 people. This is a ProPublica report. It is much more damning and wide-ranging even than just the issue of the home construction. It sounds like, on one level, there was an issue with fundraising here where this organization sort of had trouble with its balances. It saw reportedly Haiti as a very good opportunity to leverage its position and try to sort of right the financial problems they had. There's evidence reportedly in this ProPublica report that the organization knew it had enough money for all of the programs it could possibly conduct in Haiti, but kept raising money anyways. Again, there are issues with expats being favored, it looks like, instead of local Haitians, always a sensitive issue when it comes to humanitarian relief. And basically, you know, in some cases, allegedly farming out programs to other groups because the expertise was just not, you know, existent within the Red Cross system here. So, again, a lot of questions here. And I think, as some commentators have pointed out, it really raises the issue of should, you know, a charity ever just be seen as the go-to for the whole world? Maybe it's not so easy as just having, you know, one organization that we rely on everywhere. Maybe we should be really evaluating people country by country and emergency by emergency.
Or is it time for a major reboot of the Red Cross?
Yeah, I think that's definitely going to be in order.
I mean, that was supposed to happen when Bob Dole's wife took over. Elizabeth Dole became the chairwoman of the Red Cross back 20, 25 years ago, thereabouts, whatever it was. And then it was discovered that she was being paid, what, $700,000 a year or something? I mean, it was
right.
It was mind-boggling. It wasn't quite the reboot we had thought.
Look, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's these massive NGOs, you know, it's always going to be sort of an unfortunate story to report when things don't go quite as planned. You know, you want to put your faith in these institutions, but, you know, just simply the fact that they, you know, are working for humankind doesn't necessarily guarantee that everything is being run exactly how it should be.
And now WikiLeaks has a new video out that I'm in.
Yes, but many times. I saw it, in fact, last night.
Nobody asked me, but I'm in it, and I'm, you know, it's fine with me. And, you know, God bless Julian Assange. I'm a big fan. I wish he'd come on the program. And they're offering $100,000 for a glimpse of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I noticed that several of the chapters of it have just been released by WikiLeaks. So maybe somebody has taken them up on that offer. What's the story?
Well, there are two stories here. So the one you led with is the issue of fundraising to try and get what they call the most wanted secrets, the 26 chapters of the TPP that the public has not seen. There have not been more leaks on that front since this call went out. But what we did see today were the release of 17 documents from another agreement. It's called the Trade in Services Agreement, which is sort of a companion and more overarching document that would remove barriers, essentially, for the trade in services. And I, you know, that sounds like it's not such a big deal. But trade and services is sort of scary. You know, we are the services, people.
Oh, you're talking about computer programmers. You're talking about call centers. You're talking about that kind of thing, isn't it?
Exactly.
Aren't those services?
Yes. You know, the commodity in this case is personal information, our words, right. Our images. You know, we have seen in just some of these chapters released, you know, the European Union, for example, on a continental level has wanted to block information about EU citizens from being sent around the world. This treaty would remove that restriction. It says data is universal. It moves around wherever it does, and laws that impede that should not be allowed. So again, you know, this is the personal information of people. It is their names, their habits, are the services that are, you know, at stake here and being traded around not in the public eye, to say the least.
Fascinating. Plus, it makes it a whole lot easier for companies to outsource services and not pay, you know, local labor rates. Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you. Take care.
Great talking. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome to the third hour of our program. And I am pleased to have with us Brian Riley. He's the J. Van Andel Senior Policy Analyst in Trade Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Heritage.org is the website. And Brian, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be here, although I'm hungry after listening to that last segment. I want to run across the street and get some Ben & Jerry's ice cream.
There you go. Yeah, well,
the world and help myself.
Yeah, they do it good, don't they? I read a commentary by Jim DeMint and Ed Fulner and at the Heritage's website, Heritage Foundation's website, I believe it was, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, actually about the Trade Promotion Authority, Fast Track. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my understanding is that the way that Fast Track came out of the Senate, went to the House, and then got voted on in the House is that there's this assumption that millions of Americans are going to lose their jobs because of these trade deals, and therefore we're setting aside $700 million, which we've taken out of the Medicare fund, to pay for retraining the workers who have lost their jobs. And so, and that you guys are opposed to that. And one, I wanted to figure out why you're opposed to it. And number two, why would you support a trade deal that we're going to have to allocate $700 million to cover the cost of retraining people because they're going to lose? Why would anybody support a trade deal that's going to cause the loss of more American jobs?
Right. Well, and we're still waiting to see what's going to happen in the House. I think the politics of this are just so crazy to watch, where you have President Obama pushing for a trade deal. You have members of his own party working against it.
Right.
You have some Republicans traditionally have supported free trade working for it. You've got other Republicans who don't trust President Obama to have any kind of authority to do anything.
Well, and this isn't free trade. This is managed trade. I mean, free trade doesn't require, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 pages of an agreement.
That's a good point. We're supporters of free trade at the Heritage Foundation. I think that if you look around the world, countries which reduce their own special interest trade barriers are more prosperous than those that have high barriers. And I think you're exactly right, though. We could do that on our own without engaging in negotiations with other countries. That opens up a whole lot of other topics, which some directly relate to trade and some don't. We don't like the idea of associating the agreement with trade adjustment assistance. For the
purposes, for our people who are listening who don't know what you're saying, because I didn't use the proper phrase, trade adjustment assistance is that $700 million program to retrain workers who have lost their jobs because of the trade deal, right?
That's right. So you've got TPA, Trade Promotion Authority, and TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance. And part of the political deal in the Senate was, well, we're, if we want Trade Promotion Authority to negotiate trade agreements, then we will give you, you who are skeptical about trade, we'll give you this trade adjustment assistance program. Good trade agreements, in my opinion, don't destroy jobs overall. They cause changes in jobs, but we've had trade growth after all of our free trade agreements. So I dispute the notion that these agreements cause a net reduction in jobs. And we have plenty of worker assistance, whether it's unemployment insurance, and programs like that, that are available for anybody who loses their job. So they have a special program carved out. And my colleagues who study trade adjustment assistance also just feel that it's not effective. It doesn't work well. So those are the reasons that we have skepticism about the trade adjustment assistance program.
Yeah, I don't disagree that these retraining programs have in many cases been boondoggles. They have been particularly when they're outsourced and privatized to companies that kind of these will-o'-the-wisp companies. You know, they start a school and take the federal money and then the students the workers now still can't find jobs. And what are we training people for anyway?
Right. But, in those cases, maybe they're on the hook for student loans that they can't get out from under.
Right.
The idea we're going to create a program, therefore problem solved. Obviously, things aren't
so right. Is it the position of the Heritage Foundation, then, that we should not be doing Fast Track Trade Promotion Authority and that we should not be doing the what I call the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA? The administration calls it the TPP, that we shouldn't be doing the TPP?
I have not heard of SHAFTA. That's I'm surprised that other people haven't stolen that from you yet.
Yeah, please do. Let me give it to you. That and ObamaTrade. I'm guessing you've seen the website ObamaTrade.com. We had Curtis Ellis on the program a couple days ago, who runs that. It's a conservative website, that lays out the conservative argument against this particular trade agreement.
Yeah, I am familiar with ObamaTrade. I think there are legitimate questions that have been raised. At Heritage, we have things about Trade Promotion Authority that we like, and we have some things that we don't like in terms of the specific provisions that are in the long Trade Promotion Authority bill. We would like something that is a lot more direct and simple. It says, U.S. trade negotiators, your job is to go reduce trade barriers and promote economic freedom. And the TPA bill, the Trade Promotion Authority, opens up doors to a whole lot of other areas. But with respect to the trade agreement itself, our position is take a wait and see.
Is that because it's secret and none of us know what's in it?
Well, once it is released, though, then Congress has 60 days to review it. We certainly have more time to look at it than we do with many bills that are passed by Congress. So our hope is it'll be a good agreement, and let's review it at that point. And if it's not a good agreement, we shouldn't approve it. Now, different people will disagree, of course, over what would be in a good agreement and what would be in a bad agreement.
Right.
We're
talking with Brian Riley. He's a senior policy analyst in trade policy at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. Pardon my interrupting you, Brian, but we have limited time here, and I have not been able to find anybody, right, left, or center, and Sean, our executive producer, is really good at contacting people and getting them on, who will come on this program and explicitly say, yes, I am in favor of TPA, I am in favor of TPP, and here's why. I've not been able to find anybody, and I can't even find any legislators who will give a cogent, an explanation that isn't just platitudes. Why is that? Why is that? I think we all know why. In part, it's because we don't know what's in the deal. But why would Congress even be seriously considering something that has so little public support that you can't even find somebody to come on the radio and support it?
Well, TPA is, to me, a little bit of a technical insider tool that...
Well, it's Congress tying its own hands.
But also they're saying to the president, we want this. These are the positions that we want you to take in trade negotiations. So what they agree to is if you bring a trade deal back, they agree to not amend it and to consider it on an up or down vote. So you have people like me or groups like the Heritage Foundation who support free trade. And a lot of people look at trade promotion authority, and they'll think, best case scenario, this is going to create the most wonderful trade agreement ever, so we're going to support it. Or they're going to think, worst case scenario, this is going to wipe out our agreement, so we should oppose it.
Right.
And from my perspective, it's a step, it's a tool, and really what's more important is whatever trade agreement we wind up with.
Because it lasts, the Trade Promotion Authority, the fast track, because it lasts for 6 years, and the Constitution says that the House rules and Senate rules can only last for 2 years for one Congress.
Well, that's another point to me that makes this a little bit of a...
It's a constitutional issue,
right? Because the Congress can change the rules at any time, and even in the Trade Promotion Authority legislation, they say, hey, look, these are the rules today, but we agree we can change them at any time.
I see.
So that's
because we had a good conversation with Bruce Fein about that, the former Undersecretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration yesterday. Brian Riley, the J. Van Andel Senior Policy Analyst in Trade Policy at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. Brian, I appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you.
I'm getting some ice cream.
Good talking to you. Get some ice cream. There you go. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Got a few more news stories here to share with you, and we'll be picking up your calls as well. Welcome back. William in Clearwater, Florida. Hey, William. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you for encouraging me to use solar.
Okay.
Because I went ahead and did the plunge and put 5 kilowatts of photovoltaic panels on my roof, and I no longer have an energy bill.
Really?
Really?
Well, I guess it makes sense in Florida. Why isn't everybody in Florida doing this, William?
Everyone I talk to, I tell them just because I want everyone to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I took a cold call on the phone, and they ended up no money out of the pocket at all.
Right.
And so it cost me nothing to go ahead and put solar on and
wow.
creating energy.
Was it one of these deals where you're basically leasing it from them or buying it over time?
Yeah. Well, I bought it on payments,
right.
$150 a month.
And the payments are less than your electric bill used to be?
$250 was the electric bill.
Wow.
So I save $100 a month.
Amazing. Now, do you have to store power and batteries in your house, or are you still connected to the grid? You just don't use that much off the grid?
The power company here credits me everything I make during the day, so that covers my usage at night.
Oh, okay. So you sell it back to the electric company during the day, and then you buy it from them at night, and the net is zero, roughly.
Yes.
Yeah, that's marvelous.
I make more than I need, but I use 10 kilowatts at night. So
yeah,
I would have to buy that, but they just take it out of what I made them.
Right. Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Well, William, thank you. That's a great success story. Thanks for calling and sharing it with us. And
thank you, Tom.
Yeah, good talking with you. Ben in Laurel, Maryland. Hey, Ben, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
I saw you a few nights ago speaking with Richard Wolff, and I was impressed. I watch you often. I was impressed with what he had to say, in his discussion of finances and, you know, the world problems. But what he said to you at the end, he applauded you for the work that you do and your outstanding work and elucidating and clarifying things for the American public. Now, to one of your previous callers, you spoke about the Goliath scene with right-wing media. Mm-hmm. But I got to say, someone like you is, I think, important to Americans understanding where they are and getting us out of this difficulty that we're in. And an example of it to me is Thomas Paine. It's almost appalling. I was reading his Common Sense, and in the 1700s, this man is talking, and he talked about some Massanella coming along. Well, he's talking about the Constitution and taking advantage of the disquietude and upset in the country and discontent and assuming power for themselves and sweep away the liberties of the continent like a deluge. Isn't that where we are today?
Yes. I think so. You know, I think the opening, as I recall, and I'm sure that I'm mangling this, that there are probably more words and it was said in a more 17th century way. But, you know, he said, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will now no doubt shrink from the service of his country. But tyranny like hell is not easily conquered." And we're facing a new tyranny now, Ben. It's the tyranny of great wealth. And arguably, that was the tyranny we were facing in 1776. It was great wealth in England, but, that's what was going on. Ben, thank you for the call. Thank you for your kind words. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Danette in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, Danette, you had a question about the Apache, the area that the Apaches have been using for sacred ceremonies for at least 10,000 years, being sold off to a foreign, an Australian mining company by Jeff Flake and John McCain. Do I have that right?
Yes, yes. I wondered if that land is under a treaty because the Native American tribes are nations, and it's no different than having a treaty with England or Japan or France or China. And if they are selling off land that belongs to another nation, aren't they in violation of a treaty agreement?
If they were, they would be, yes. That land is not actually...
argument. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That land is not actually part of the San Carlos Apache Reservation. It is contiguous to it. It's next door to it. It's essentially a national park, and everybody is welcome to use it, and the Apaches have been using it, you know, for 10,000 years, and they continue to use it. As I said, I've been there with them using it. And because it was set aside as a national park during the Eisenhower administration, now the national park part goes back to Teddy Roosevelt, but during the Eisenhower administration recognized that this was being used by the Apaches as sacred land. And so they forbade oil exploration or mineral exploration there and said it could only be used for basically recreational use, which would include, you know, religious activities. So it didn't have the protection of a treaty. It simply had, you know, it was a matter of policy. And so John McCain and Jeff Flake were able to, you know, steal it on behalf of Rio Tinto's subsidiary so that they can build this, you know, giant 1,000-foot across, you know, it looks like a moon crater from the sky copper mine there. So, unfortunately.
That's really no different than what we discussed yesterday with the United States not making anything, you know? I mean,
yeah.
They're just selling chunks of the United States off to the highest bidders, but they can they can act like patriots by putting on a flag pin.
Yeah.
And I think that we give John McCain a free pass because of his military service. And I think that is the height of hypocrisy. How dare you be willing to die for this country, but then you're willing to sell it off to the highest bidder?
Yeah.
I don't think that's right at all. It's awful.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you, Danette. And now might be a good time to call 202-225-3121 and let John McCain and Jeff Flake know what you think about stealing Apache lands, and then let your member of Congress know, because it's possible that Congress could reverse this. Danette, thank you very much for the call. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for calling.
This is my first opportunity to get back with you, but a few days ago, you were pondering the question why Scott Walker had a lead in Iowa.
Right.
And you were asking the question, are the Koch brothers or are these other nonprofits,
independent groups, in quotes, yeah.
Right. And I'm not much of a I don't watch over-the-air television that much. I check in on my regular news in the evenings, and I haven't noticed that there's a lot of spending. But after you mentioned that, I had to think about it. And over the last 3 months, about one every month, I've been getting. Now, I'm a registered Democrat,
mm-hmm.
and I was involved in the struggles back when Walker was under recall and everybody was up in arms in Wisconsin, and I tried to support them as long as I could with minor donations.
Mm-hmm.
But I started receiving about 3 months ago mailers from the Scott Walker campaign, you know, outlining his positions and this and that and asking for donations. So that is the one thing that I can identify on the ground in Western Iowa where Walker may have a slight advantage. And
so you think that what's boosting his numbers is name recognition, which is coming about by virtue of direct mail rather than television advertising?
I'm willing to throw that in for your consideration.
Yeah. Are you getting that for the other Republican candidates in
no.
similar quantities?
No.
Okay.
No. Could I touch on your last caller, the Apache lands?
Sure.
I saw a great, and I can't recall it at the on the spur of the moment, but I saw a great documentary, and it was about the wild horses and the Apaches out in that neck of the woods, and what was happening to their land through the Bureau of Land Management and stuff, and the federal government had a remedy an excuse for that, and it was called gradual encroachment on the lands that they were granted under treaties.
Mm-hmm.
So they never really got justice in the courts. The Native Americans have not gotten justice through the court system
right.
in protecting treaties that were enforced, supposed to be enforced.
Yeah, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. It's the great shame of America, Randy, and it's something that we just never, ever discuss. Thanks a lot for the call. Marty in Monroe, North Carolina. Hey, Marty, do I have this right? You think that white guys who create gangs that shoot things up and beat each other up with chains are not actually gangs? They're only gangs if they're black people?
Well, it's not just that. It's just the entity of a motorcycle club, and there are other clubs other than the Bandidos, the Hells Angels, the Outlaws, yada, yada, yada. You have the Marine Corps Leathernecks. They are insulted by being considered a gang.
Well, I'm not calling them a gang.
The Blue Knights.
Yeah.
I didn't say you personally. You as a whole. The government, the media, the people. Then you have the Blue Knights. The police.
No, my point, Marty, was that when black people behave badly in groups, we refer to them as gangs. And when white people refer badly in groups, we tend not to refer to them as gangs. When black people behave individually badly, we refer to them as thugs. When white people behave badly individually, we refer to them as disturbed or mentally ill or upset or whatever. We have different language. Our language, Marty, thank you for the call. Our language and our messaging perpetuates racial and amplifies even racial stereotypes and racism within our society.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And thus further locks people of color into situations that are harder and harder to get out of. We'll be back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Rick Perry, I just saw this over at Politicus USA. Rick Perry is facing 109 years in prison. 109 years in prison. And he's running for the Republican nomination for President of the United States. I guess that makes sense if you're a Republican, you know? Maybe. I don't know. Anyhow, Matthew, in New Zealand, Matthew?
Hi, I'm just listening to your program, and what's always amazed me was the fact that New Zealand, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and America all went through the process of neoliberalism in the 1980s. However, all those countries, barring America, there was always a line drawn as to we go no further. In the case of New Zealand, it was the 90s, and our finance minister was going off to the deep end. The prime minister said, no, we're holding right here, and no further privatisation happened. Same thing happened in the United Kingdom. Nobody ever touched the NHS. It was always the thing that you never touched. But there never seemed to be that line drawn in the United States, as in, we go no further. This is where we draw the line, and we're not going any further to the right than that. It just kept on moving further and further and further, to the point that even the Conservative parties, in the case of New Zealand and United Kingdom, can't even relate to the Republican Party in the United States. It's gone so far to the right that there's no common ground anymore.
Right. In other words, the Conservative parties in New Zealand, where you're calling from, and Australia and the UK, the idea that we should do away with the national health care system, for example, is not something that a Conservative would endorse in those countries. And yet it is here. The idea that the public schools should be privatized and sold off to the highest bidders is not something that would fly in those countries. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the main thing. I mean, that's the only way the National Party actually got in. They John Key, for all the debates there about him, basically came out and said, we're going to be more centre than the Labour Party. The Labour Party, for 9 years, basically ran the country from the centre, with public health, public education, all the major power generations owned by the government, the post offices. And I generally use that as an example to Americans that there are numerous examples around the world where government-owned businesses are actually run efficiently. New Zealand Post made a profit of $100 million this year and also have their own bank. So, you know, government-run institutions can actually be run efficiently as the private sector. So what there seems to be is a lack of willingness, at least for some moderation within some of the rights in the United States. You know, there was kind of an addiction to the whole idea of neoliberalism, and then suddenly there was a reality check at some point whereby they eventually fell out of favor.
Well, isn't it, Matthew, that in your country and in the rest of the Anglo-Saxon, shall we say, or English-speaking world outside of the United States, that there is a clear understanding of what the commons are, you know, what is public space and what is private space? What is the appropriate role of government in terms of protecting life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Whereas in the United States, we seem not to really understand where those lines should be drawn historically, both historically and practically.
Yeah, and there's also the other point that although you have the issue of people being able to run their own business and being able to make a profit and everything, there's also the understanding that, you know, the idea of the community. Yes, we're individuals, but we also look outside our own individuals and ask ourselves, what kind of society do we want? And that involves, you know, public health and education, all these kinds of things that we collectively come together and pay for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even, like I said, even someone who, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, Stephen Tindall, for example, started up the warehouse. talks about the fact that, you know, we need to have those kinds of institutions there to ensure that everybody has an opportunity to actually reach their full potential in society. I mean, yeah, like I said, it's a bit haphazard. It's about 6 o'clock in the morning here, so so forget what I mean.
Yeah, no, I got it. Matthew, thank you for the call, and thank you for the New Zealand perspective, and thanks for watching us on YouTube there in New Zealand live.
Okay. Wow,
6 o'clock in the morning. Good talking with you. Thank you very much. Charlene in Gilbert, Arizona. Hey, Charlene. Thanks for
Tom.
Thanks for listening to Tom.
I don't know if you saw it. It was kind of under the radar if you're not a stock investor, but there was information last week published that in the newspapers, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, that Humana is considering selling itself.
Merging with another health insurance company or?
Yeah. One story said that they got an offer from Cigna, and another story said that they've actually decided to put themselves up for sale, that their CFO that they brought on, I think in 2012, 2013, within the last couple of years, he's a merger and acquisition specialist. He came from one of the big, you know, the big companies that does M&A.
Right.
And there was an article, if you Google Humana sale, you'll see there's an article that states that Governor Beshear said he's going to do everything to try to keep Humana going and in Kentucky because they're one of the biggest employers for Kentucky.
Right. I talked about this last week, I think it was. The Financial Times had an article about how the United States just hit a high in mergers and acquisitions that we haven't seen since the mid-2000s, and that seems similar to the original mergers and acquisitions mania that happened when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 82, and we saw this happening throughout the 80s. And, you know, as big companies started merging and shedding redundant workers, you have two companies, they become one company, they no longer need two bookkeeping departments, they no longer need two sales departments, they no longer, you know, so lots and lots of people lose their jobs. But the people who are the beneficiaries are the senior executives. Their stock options go up dramatically. They get huge fees for making these things happen. And the banksters who make it happen as well. And I'm wondering, Charlene, I'm wondering if the reason why mergers and acquisitions activity in the United States right now is so high, because every time one of these things happens, you mint new billionaires and you mint new 100 millionaires. You know, people, you know, a half a dozen, maybe two dozen people at the very, very top get insanely wealthy. And I'm wondering if the 1/100th of 1% class sees the crash coming and is just trying to grab everything they can, because these mergers and acquisitions do not help the country. They don't generally help the company. Except in as much as they diminish competition and thus they allow the companies to increase their prices. I mean, this is like the pharmaceutical companies buying up the generic companies and then doubling the prices of generic drugs because they now own the entire marketplace. No more competition. But, you know, that's the only thing that I can, that and the fact that right now it's easy to borrow enormous amounts of money at very low rates to facilitate these deals. But, you know, once the interest rates go up, these big companies are going to be in big trouble.
And they said in all the articles that once the announcement was made that they were considering selling the company, I don't know what the stock was at prior to that, but it went up to $213.
Yeah, there you go. And at that point, a bunch of executives said, okay, I'm going to exercise my stock options and take the money and pay a maximum capital gains tax on it. I saw today that there was a speculation that Dish and T-Mobile might be merging. I mean, there's all these mergers in all these different sectors. And, you know, we really have not had a national conversation about whether this is a good or a bad thing functionally since the 1930s. You know, I mean, when Reagan changed the policies on mergers and acquisitions in the 80s, everyone thought, well, okay, let's see what happens. And, you know, of course, the big got bigger, the small got eaten. The medium-sized companies largely vanished. Family businesses were destroyed. But it took us a couple of decades to figure that out. But we're still going down that same road. It's crazy. So, Charlene, thank you for sharing that information with me and with all of us and giving me an opportunity to go off on that riff about it. I just think that M&A activity for M&A activity. I mean, occasionally a strategic merger makes sense. But when you're doing it basically to jack up your stock prices so your executives can pull a couple hundred million bucks out and, you know, go buy a hidey hole in Ecuador or something, I got a problem with it. Charlene, thank you for the call. Michael in Newport, Kentucky, we got a minute to the break. Michael, it's yours. Michael? Let's try Bob in Medina, Ohio. Hey, Bob.
Yes, I had two things I want you to comment on, but I'll take it one.
Okay.
Well, how did Greece get themselves into the mess they're in now? I know I've heard you talk about
The principal way they got into the mess was they didn't have their debt ratio was too high to get them into the European Union. You had to have no more than 3% of GDP debt, going into the EU, and they were above that. So Goldman Sachs came in, bought their debt from them, and then sold it back to them as something that's not called debt. It was basically derivatives. So Greece still owed the money, but they owed it in a way that didn't look like they owed the money. And then when the financial crash happened and Goldman and these other companies that were involved with this, they basically had to say, okay, pay us now. And Greece ended up getting screwed. Greece wasn't the only one, by the way. Spain, the same thing happened. Bob, that's the...
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
If you plug into one of the search engines, Greece, Matt Taibbi, and Goldman, I'm sure you'll find the story because Matt Taibbi did some great reporting on this. Thanks, Bob. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And it's anything goes summer, by the way. If there's anything you want to talk about, feel free to give us a shout. Harold in Upland, Indiana. Hey, Harold, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Harold? Oh, the phones have croaked again? It's our perennial... Amazing. Okay, let me try James in Spokane, Washington, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, James, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. How you doing? You're my favorite Uncle Tom, by the way.
Okay. What's up, James?
I mentioned to Danielle. I wonder what you'd think about it. This timing of the Ukrainian crisis.
Yeah.
And Edward Snowden seems a little coincidental to me.
How so?
Well, I mean, they gave him safe harbor. Anyone who does that, we demand they give him up.
Right.
We can't do that with Russia.
Right.
So what do we do?
Right. So you think that the United States and the NATO countries staged this coup in Ukraine as a way of punishing Russia for giving protection to Edward Snowden? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think Occam's razor probably points to that.
Could be. If you want to do Occam's razor, I would go back 3 years or so to the Bloomberg story about how Chevron, an American oil company, I'm pretty sure it was Chevron, cut a $10 billion deal with Ukraine to be able to frack the shale oil underneath Ukraine. Ukraine doesn't have oil, but they've got an enormous amount of Bakken shale, the stuff that they've got in North Dakota, and billions and billions of dollars worth of oil and natural gas that they can frack out of there. And, the government apparently wasn't going to go along with it. And then the new government is going to, as far as I know, is going to go along with it. I think it has more to do with natural resources, frankly, and also, NATO trying to push up against Russia's border, which I think is very, very dangerous. But who knows? Who knows? I'd have to line up the timelines. Have you done that, James?
No, not at all. I just know that anytime somebody steps on our toes, we don't spare any resources to pay them back.
Well, I think that might, one of the things I've noticed is that it seems that President Obama has, almost a personal animus against both Putin and Netanyahu. And, whether it's Ed Snowden or whether it's other things, I honestly don't know. But, it's interesting times. James, got to move along. Thank you for the call. Michael in Newport, Kentucky. A minute to the break, Michael. What's up?
Yeah, I want to touch on the thing about this deal with Republicans' religion, and it mind boggles me to how it's being ignored. Now, you got the Ten Commandments. That's the law. They play on this gays and lesbian stuff and transgenders, but I don't see nothing in the Ten Commandments about the gays and lesbians the way they religiously portray and talk about.
Right.
Now, you got murderers, liars, and thieves, and I think the one, too, is thou shalt not judge, is in the Ten Commandments, and the Republicans are breaking every rule there is, and it's being totally ignored by the religion people.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Hypocrisy is not the sole property of any one political party, but when it comes to religious hypocrisy, I think the Republicans are right at the top of the list. Somebody needs to print out Matthew 25 and pass it around the Republican Party. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, this Gaius Publius sent me this note. It's over at thesmirkingchimp.com. Marty Kaplan writing about the FCC chief Tom Wheeler is 5/6 of a superhero is the article. And it says the Federal Communication Commission, you know, yesterday we were talking about how Mary Jo White at the Securities and Exchange Commission has the power tomorrow. Well, yeah, tomorrow's a weekday. Tomorrow to require any publicly traded company in the United States, any company that's listed on a stock exchange, which is who the SEC regulates, to require them to disclose political activity, right? Whether it's lobbying activity or whether it's supporting political candidates, she has the power to do that. And she has chosen not to do that. And Public Citizen has launched a campaign to encourage her to do that. We passed out her phone number yesterday, which was 202-551-2100, so that people could respectfully register their opinions. The FCC, Tom Wheeler, chairman of the FCC, who got 4 million contacts, mostly petitions, about net neutrality, it turns out he's got magic powers, too. And this is according to Michael Copps, who used to be for 10 years, was a commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. So he would have the knowledge of this. And in fact, Jim, I emailed you the YouTube clip on this. There's a YouTube clip floating around, but you can see it over at smirkingchimp.com. And I don't think we have it available right now, but we can talk about it next week. But here's what Michael Copps said. We have had on the books since the original Telecommunications Act of 1934 a requirement that the sponsors of ads, including political ads, must be identified. And all we have to do is start enforcing it. We don't have to wait for the president to send a disclosure bill to Congress that won't go anywhere. We don't have to wait for Congress to bite the hand that feeds it. The FCC can do that rulemaking on its own. And after a 120-day public comment period, 3-month comment period, or 4-month, I guess that would be, if you conceal who's paying for those ads, you'll get nailed. And Copps says, enforcing that provision is at the top of my bucket list, and I'm looking for company, Tom. And the Tom he's talking about is Thomas Wheeler, who is the chairman of the FCC. So, something to think about. Mark, in New York City. Hey, Mark, you wanted to talk about the M&A bubble? Mark? Oh, no, Mark's on line 8. Mark, I can't hear you. If you can hear me, call right back. You'll hit a different line, and we will get you on. We're having Comcast problems here with some of our phone lines. Liz in West Hollywood, California. Liz, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great.
I called Boxer's office yesterday in Washington, and I spoke to a gentleman, and I told him that I was really concerned about the loss of sovereignty if the TPP goes through. And I'm really surprised at Barbara Boxer. I voted for her all these years, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he said to me that the fast track that she voted for had a 60-day review period in it. Now, I never heard of such a thing. I thought if it was fast track, it goes right to the president's desk.
No. Well, what'd you say, Shane? Oh, yeah. What it says is the TPA goes right to the president's desk, yes, if it gets passed by the House of Representatives, fast track. What the fast track does, though, is it defines the terms of the debate for the TPP, for SHAFTA, for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it does say that, yes, Congress has 60 days to look at it, but debate is limited to 83 seconds per member of Congress, as Alan Grayson has talked about on this program. And 80, you may 83 seconds.
80, and, all big 80.
And you may not offer amendments. They may not amend it in any way. It's a straight up or down vote, and it cannot be filibustered. So, yeah, there's a 60-day review period, but that's relatively meaningless.
Oh, so I'm going to call them back and tell them. I don't know who I'm going to speak to, but I noticed that the Washington office is better than the local office. I mean, they're very nice in both places, but when you call the local office, sometimes I guess you must get a student.
Yeah.
And you don't get people who really know.
Yeah, although the bottom line is, Liz, no matter who you call, they're basically just going to mark on a spreadsheet, you know, yes or no. This was a call against TPA, TPP. This was a call in favor of TPA, TPP.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, I realize.
You know, they're not going to get into long philosophical or detailed explanations, but this fig leaf, this 60-day fig leaf is just that. It's a fig leaf. 60 days is nowhere near long enough for Congress to evaluate a multi-thousand-page document where most of the language in it, because it's modifying a whole bunch of existing laws, instead of saying things like, you know, when you trade with China, you will have to do fill out this form, and instead it says things like Section 305 of U.S. Code 123 which shall be modified on line 7 to no longer read "and by the authority," but instead "or by the authority." So then what you have to do is you have to go back and you have to find that piece of law and find out what the heck it's talking about. And that's, you know, it's filled with that. And there's no way in 60 days that Congress can carefully, comprehensively, and thoroughly evaluate anything this big. I mean, this has taken years to negotiate. This was started during the George W. Bush administration. We are, you know, 8 years into the negotiations on TPP, and they want Congress to do this in 60 days and not be allowed to amend it if they find something they don't like. That's crazy. That's just crazy.
And we're losing our sovereignty over a trade bill.
Yes, we are turning our economic sovereignty over to a group of 600 multinational corporations who wrote this deal. Liz, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and thanks to everybody for calling in today. Mark, I'm sorry, on the M&A bubble, give me a call, you know, tomorrow or Friday, or next week, and we will continue the conversation. And same with Lucas and Norman, the other folks who are on hold. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require you to participate. Get out there, get active, tag your it. I'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.